Good morning. It is lovely to be back. And haven't you been busy? Elections all over the shop. Just over 1 week in from the dissolution of the Dáil, and if they're not eyeballing you from lampposts, candidates and canvassers are pounding the pavements, kissing the babies, to get your number one. And in general election 2024, there's a lot more of you to court and woo.
This response has been extraordinary. We have been campaigning with both the local authorities and the Department of Housing for the last month or so to really encourage people to check the register, to get themselves out to vote, because their vote is their voice. And the numbers speak for themselves. 115,000 so far. Well, the deadline was yesterday. So 115,000 in November, which brings the total of new voters this year to just over 400,000. So,
Art O'Leary from the Electoral Commission on Drive Time. And when it came to registering, some of us were a little bit last minute.
And there was a big surge, wasn't there, in the final 2 days before the deadline?
Oh, there was. I mean, the 2 days we had nearly 55,000 people who checked the register. So sometimes this is a very Irish thing. You know, we check our passports today before we go on holidays, and we have a tendency to leave things to the last moment. So my heart goes out to the local authority workers, and my best wishes to them as well, whose job it is now in the next week or so to ensure that every single one of those people who applied before the deadline end up safely on the register. So there's a big job of work to be done here, but the local authorities have done this in March and they've done it in June, and we expect them to complete the task this month.
And on a word in edgeways with John O'Donnell, he's putting on the anorak all right, but it is a little frayed around the edges.
We love it, of course. The arguments, the point scoring, cries of foul and dirty tactics. And that's just the political commentators. Every word leaked out from team meetings, every bland press conference pronouncement is pounced upon and parsed and analysed. When he says X, is he really saying Y? TV, radio, newspapers, social media, it's all they can talk about. Here's how this lot could pull off a famous win. Here's a way the other crowd could lose. We're all pundits now. In every shop and pub, and hairdressers and butchers, and cattle mart and farm machinery suppliers, it's the same question, asked and answered every time. Well, what do you think?
But however you're thinking, whatever you do, don't throw it all away. No matter how well-intentioned. Yes, we're talking to you, Conway O. Back to Art O'Leary.
Work your way through the ballot paper, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, for as far as you like to go, and don't write anything else on the ballot paper. It may be that next year the Dubs will win the All-Ireland again, but please don't write up the Dubs or Mayo for Sam or anything else on the ballot paper, because that could spoil your vote.
So no messing, not even for Mayo. But now to the aftermath of that other election. Yes, you turn your back for one hot minute and it is all change. Now a return to the Oval Office for Donald J. Trump. The US president-elect dominated the news this week with his cabinet nominees. There were, I think it's fair to say, some unusual choices. First up, Pete Hegseth, Fox News host. He's been appointed defence secretary. On Drive Time, Cormac spoke to Professor of American Studies, Scott Lucas.
Apparently, there are really experienced veterans in the Pentagon saying, Pete who?
They've said it with ruder terms that I can't put on the air
really?
to your listeners. Yeah, because Pete Hegseth, like, he was a soldier. You know, he served in the military, but he was never, like, then in a later military position. He has no experience of being an officer in the military. Mm-hmm. He has no experience of an administrative role. He has no experience in policymaking. He has no experience in anything other than being a talking head on TV. And a talking head on TV who denounced veterans for taking money off of the government. He said some other very, very controversial things. He said some frankly crazy things, like that he never washes his hands, make of that what you will. But the serious thing about his appointment is that Hegseth has said he's going to fire all the woke generals. Now, of course, he's using the woke without any meaningful notion of that term. He's basically saying, I'm going to get rid of the generals and the admirals who I don't like. Why is that important? Because Donald Trump's team in Project 2025 have said they're going after the military. They're going after the generals and the admirals and the Air Force commanders who don't support Trump, including the current head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Charles Brown. So you're looking at a possible purge of the military. And why is that? Because Trump had a lot of the military who worked with him in his first term. Remember his White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, mm-hmm. who was a four-star general, his Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, who was a general, his, of course, Chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who was a general. And they have said either that he's not up to the job or even that he's a fascist.
So he doesn't want that anymore. He doesn't want that criticism anymore.
And then for the appointment of Elon Musk, not quite cabinet, but tasked with co-leading a newly created Department of Government Efficiency. Let's go to the News at One with Niall Stanage, White House columnist with The Hill. He spoke to Rachel.
What has Donald Trump been saying about the role of Elon Musk?
Well, he talks about Elon Musk as someone who's capable of bringing entrepreneurship to the management of government, bringing a whole new style to that. Now, obviously, that's a claim that a lot of people will be sceptical of. Elon Musk, initially perhaps best known for Tesla, but more recently X, formerly known as Twitter. The other thing about Mr. Musk is that he has previously claimed he could cut $2 trillion from the federal budget. If he did that, it would be roughly one-third of all government spending. So it seems a fanciful idea and one that, if it were enacted, would obviously cause massive cuts to services.
And then, for Attorney General, we have Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz. Here's Claire with Terry Sheridan, News Director at WSHU Public Radio.
He is a firebrand. He has been called the most hated person in Congress, and that comes from Republicans. He was the one who held up the process to appoint Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House 2 years ago. And then last year, he led the effort to have McCarthy deposed as Speaker and then held up the process to appoint his successor, Mike Johnson, when he was appointed. He is under investigation by the House, or was, for sexual improprieties with a 17-year-old, also for alleged illegal drug use. The Department of Justice was investigating him. They decided not to prosecute him, but he is still under investigation, was under investigation in the House. He immediately resigned his seat yesterday, meaning that the House has lost jurisdiction in this investigation. There are reports that they were going to release the report on Matt Gaetz on Friday. Now it's uncertain if that report will ever see the light of day.
What does this appointment of Matt Gaetz tell you about the direction of Trump's administration?
It's basically telling us that what he said on the campaign trail is what he wants to do. He wants to basically blow up the government. The people he's appointed, you know, whether it's Matt Gaetz, whether it's Tulsi Gabbard, are people who are, number one, loyal to him. Number two, very controversial. In most cases, not qualified to do the job. A strictly political pick. And it points that he's looking to, if I say shake up, that's being nice. He's looking to go in, you know, and basically take down much of the federal government.
And yesterday, to top off a week of appointments, the newsroom brought us this.
Shares in European vaccine companies fell by 3% in early trading. The drop followed the announcement by the US president-elect Donald Trump that he was nominating the vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be his health secretary. The head of the US Public Health Association, Dr. George C. Benjamin, said the appointment posed sizable risks to the health of the nation.
He's not trained in any health discipline. He doesn't have the management skills to manage such a complex organization. He certainly doesn't have the temperament for it. And he's not trusted because of his disinformation and misinformation experiences, you know, the work that he's done over several years around vaccines, and even some of his more exaggerated claims in the environment.
Now, it bears repeating that Donald Trump did win with a resounding majority of votes from US citizens. And the Republican Party is now in control of the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the White House. Surely happy days for the grand old party. On Morning Ireland, Justin spoke to former Nevada Republican State Chair Amy Tarkanian.
They're absolutely thrilled. And I think actually, you know, as we see that the election was pretty much a mandate. So the American people overall are thrilled with new beginnings, I guess you could call them.
And the clean sweep now means that President Trump really has pretty much absolute control to implement his agenda. He'll be able to pursue the mass deportations that he promised, aggressive tax cuts, shutting down the Department of Education, curbing powers of some state agencies, almost unchecked, will it be, because he has so much control?
Well, I mean, thankfully, we do have a system of checks and balances. And yes, I understand that the Republicans are in control of all three branches of government. However, he's still going to have to work across party aisle. And he's also going to have to work, you know, with the Republicans who maybe didn't support him from the beginning that are in the Senate, in the House. And so, you know, a number of these issues, and one of them that you mentioned was the mass deportations. That's something that he cannot do unilaterally. That's something that will be met with legal battles. There are also a number of other issues that are going to require a constitutional amendment, which is an uphill battle, because that's basically where it would have to be ratified by 3/4 of the states and proposed by Congress. So there are a number of very large items that he had campaigned on that most likely we would not see come to fruition, but he's going to do his very best to at least chip away.
There you have it. Back in a bit. Sorry. Welcome back. Nothing says the Irish at home or abroad like a packet of Tato. Created in 1954 by Joe Spud Murphy, the man knew how to flog his cheese and onion. And now a new book celebrates the crisp, with some proceeds going to its charity partner Alone, with Oliver former sales manager Jerry Lloyd and MD John O'Connor.
Joe was a fantastic marketeer. He was a man before his time, and it, you know, we hear the term guerrilla marketing now, but he was doing guerrilla marketing before it was even a term that was known. And he's some great stories about that. The van, the Tato van, would accidentally, on purpose, supposedly break down in the street.
In very busy junctions.
In a very busy junction, and sit there for a couple of hours, so to speak. And when there was always a good football final or a hurling final on in Croke Park, Joe would send the trucks out and they would drive around Croke Park and people would turn around and say, how many trucks have you got? You must have hundreds of trucks. It was probably only a couple of trucks. So he was really clever in terms of his marketing at that stage of the brand, you know.
And Mr. Tato is there from very early on, isn't he? There's a picture of the oldest known packet.
Yeah.
And he's there with his hat and everything.
He wasn't there on the first pack, Jerry. I think it was about a year and a half later that he came, but he was literally only in the corner.
Yeah, yeah. And he was just there in the corner. He was a drawing from one of his kids.
Is that right?
That's where he came from, a potato head. Yeah. And it grew from that, and it became, obviously, over the years, much, much more prominent. It was amazing from that point of view.
And when he popped into the shop in his Rolls Royce, he wasn't just going in for a pint of milk.
Describe what he looked like to people if you met him in the heyday.
Oh, you would know him. He was very dapper. He'd walk in anywhere. He was very prominent. You know, he got out of the Rolls Royce. And one of his tactics was to go into a shop with the Rolls Royce parked outside.
He'd
and
pull
say,
up on a Rolls Royce outside a shop and go in. He'd go to shops who didn't know him, didn't he?
Yes, absolutely. And call in and say, do you have any of those, potato chips? Or, oh, my kids were looking for them. And, no, never heard of them. And a van would come a couple of hours later into the shop selling potatoes.
And they would go, oh, we had a man inquiring earlier on.
Correct.
But these must be popular.
Yeah.
Until they started to cop on that there's some guy going around
in a
Rolls Royce.
I'd say it was easy to spot.
Asking for crisps.
And if you were really committed to your cheese and onion, way back in 2007, you could have voted for Mr. Tato in the general election.
The Taoiseach at the time, Bertie Ahern, called a snap election. Mm-hmm. We were trying to figure out what sort of a marketing campaign we would do, and all of a sudden we said, put him in for election. And that was the craziness and the mischievousness of what we would do. So put him up for election. So he ran for election. Frank Kelly of Father Ted fame was his election agent, Mr. Tato doesn't talk. He's afraid to be misquoted, so to speak. So Frank led the campaign, and ever since then Mr. Tato has been.
It was a very funny campaign.
It was a very funny campaign.
Like, on stamp duty, he said, there should be no obligation to buy stamps.
Yep, yep, yep. Or what does this cabinet look like? Well, it should be solid mahogany with gold inlays. Yeah, there was.
So Frank Kelly was the spokesman. He was kind of the PJ Mara character.
Exactly.
And he said, class sizes, big issue. They should be under 12 foot by 9 foot.
Exactly.
Now, there's a candidate we could all get behind. With Aideen on Lyric at the weekend, Between the Ears, a tribute to the life and career of composer Henry Mancini. This was how it opened.
Once I got the first three notes, da da da, then I said, where else can I go? Then I said, where else can I go?
You know, he had a very clever way of weaving the melody throughout the film.
It's actually a BBC first.
In addition to being able to write a film score, he was able to write hit songs.
Just suggest this sense of wonder and of possibility.
Because I believe that melody is the soul of communication with people as far as entertainment goes, you know.
I mean, this was the hippest music around.
The winner is Henry Mancini.
Henry Mancini.
Henry Mancini.
Mr. Henry Mancini.
I was having a little hot chocolate with a friend of mine, and I get this tap on the shoulder. Young couple there, and they said, are you Henry Mancini? Said, well, yes, I am. I said, you dropped your credit card.
Ooh, cruel. And all of that to soften you up for this next bit. COP29, it's on in Baku in Azerbaijan. And with Valencia and now Malaga, our most recent examples of extreme weather, you would think that this is the opportunity to take some action on our climate emergency. Well, you think that. Here's the view of journalist George Monbiot with Claire.
It's being chaired by a former oil executive. I suppose you could say that's an improvement on being chaired by a serving oil executive. But this really is the vampires in charge of the blood bank. And already we're seeing the way that lobbying by fossil fuel companies dominates this process. In fact, there was an undercover investigation which showed the COP executive in Azerbaijan actually facilitating a meeting between someone who claimed to be an investor and the state oil company in order to exploit more fossil fuels. The exact opposite of what this meeting is set up to do. And, you know, I've become pretty cynical about this whole process. We've had 28 of these meetings. Two of them have partially succeeded. If we sort of give them a sort of 50% success to each of those two, that means overall we've got a 3.6% success rate over these 28 meetings that have taken place so far. If any other process had a 3.6% success rate, we would abandon it and start again and introduce a better process which is more likely to work.
That's harsh, but is it fair?
Because we had this... Well, it was described as a breakthrough by the COP29 president, who I mentioned earlier. This deal on carbon credits, so wealthier countries offset their carbon by purchasing credits from countries that have cut greenhouse gases above what they promised. Is that a breakthrough or not?
No, I mean, they'll do anything except what needs to be done, which is to curtail the fossil fuel and livestock industries, which are the two biggest drivers of this disaster. And, you know, that doesn't even feature in any of the resolutions of any of the meetings so far. So instead, they use these pathetic substitutes. And it's a bit like sort of pushing the food around in your plate to pretend that you've eaten your meal. You know, we'll move it from this country to that country. And so all this is just a displacement activity. It's just a way of not grasping what needs to be done, fundamentally leaving fossil fuels in the ground.
George Monbiot on COP29 with Claire. Now to Liveline, which took a call with Christine on Tuesday. She'd ordered a dress online. It hadn't arrived.
No sign of it, Joe. It's been about 2.5 weeks now at this stage.
And when were you?
I'm kind of thinking, that's strange, you know, that it hasn't come so far. So I'm just wondering, does anybody know the shop in Cork or have they ordered from it before?
Now, I hear you. This is hardly headline-making stuff. But it would turn out to be just the start of it.
But you see, is it in Cork? Because it doesn't. It says Ciara Cork underneath it.
Well, it also says Patrick Street on the site, Joe. It does, because when I went in, yes, I mean, I saw the style and I thought, wow, this is fabulous, and had fabulous autumnal colours. And
right.
All the dresses are all kind of called after an Irish name, other kind of Irish names that are out there. So I thought, yeah, I'm dealing with an Irish company, and that made me feel good. So I thought, yeah, let's keep the shops on the high street, give them a bit of business. And subsequently, when they received my first order, they sent me a thank you for the order and a 20% off my next order.
Ah.
So, Joe, of course, being, you know, thinking I was clever, I ordered 4 items from them.
Okay. Ciara Cork. But yeah. Is there a number on the Patrick Street address? Like, Pat,
I think it said 1 Patrick Street. I'm not 100% on that now, Joe, but I think it was 1 Patrick Street. If anybody up there might know it, that'd be great, you know? Mm-hmm.
Oh, the very best of luck with that one, because all of those also Irishy sounding names would turn out not to be very Irish at all, more Asian in fact. But you would get what you ordered, well, kind of. You didn't actually want it to fit now, did you?
Blue cotton jumper, what arrived?
Blue cotton jumper did arrive, Joe, but it was far too small.
Okay.
So
this is Kelly Galway.
Kelly Galway.
Yes.
I said, I have to return this.
Yeah.
So I got an email address, emailed them away, and they said to return it.
Yes.
And they'd be very happy to receive it. And as soon as they did, they'd give me a refund. So I said, well, what's the address? And it was downtown Dubai.
Oh, good luck.
Yeah.
Slattery. What's the first name they use?
Aidan's in Kildare.
Oh, Kildare, of course.
Well, I seen this court online, and anyway, it did arrive and after about a week, but it wasn't a bit like the court that was in the picture that I ordered. The material was completely different, and the buttonholes didn't match up like that. When you're putting it up, it was puckery in the front.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And how much did you spend, Margie?
$44.95. They said it was 149.
So you saved, Maria, 105.
Well, I thought I was getting a bargain, yeah.
I know.
I couldn't believe it. I was listening to yesterday, and I was only kind of half paying attention to the radio. Next thing I heard, O'Connor come there. I said, oh, Jesus, here we go again. I bought a jacket. It's like another one the pilots used to wear in World War II.
The airman's jacket.
Next thing I heard that yesterday, so I only bought it last Saturday, but I don't hold out much hope.
How much did you pay for it for the finish?
€64.
Oh, 60.
Gone to the website, Smith Kildare, looked at this lovely denim dress that was advertised. It was from London, and you could buy it in Kildare, in Smith in Kildare.
Okay.
So, of course, I clicked the button to buy, and then they gave me an option. If I wanted to buy 2, I would get 20% off my second one.
Of course.
They were €40 each, so I think I got them for €65, the 2 dresses.
For the 2, yeah.
Eventually, after I think about 4 weeks, the 2 dresses arrived. I didn't even open it up because just by looking at it, Joe, I thought, oh my God, what am I up to doing? Could I describe it, Joe? I couldn't describe it. You held up the dresses and you could see through them. You could see through the dresses. They were like paper. Mm-hmm. I ordered a large size. They would fit a size 8, I'd say. And I'm not a size 8, unfortunately. So anyway, I got on straight away and I said the dresses were too small in the first place and could I get a refund? Yeah. Yeah. No, we'll give you, you can keep your dresses and we'll give you like 40% off your next order. Yeah. If we can do anything to help you, Liz, please let us know. Mm-hmm. We know it's very frustrating and this. And I thought, oh my God. I said, I just want a refund. That's all I want.
Yeah.
Well, now, you know, Liz, if you send these dresses back to us, it's going to cost you a lot of money and we cannot cover postage. And I replied, that's not a problem. It doesn't matter. Mm. I wasn't going to let them away with it. I just thought, I don't care if it cost me €50. Off I went to the post office with my 2 dresses. They sent me a return form. And when I looked at the address, it was China.
And Martin, what shop are you talking about online?
I'm talking about O'Connor Kildare. I bought a jacket, right? Uh-huh. Now, this jacket was supposed to be a winter jacket.
Yeah.
And I ordered it in burgundy. I had about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 emails from them telling me that the shipment was on the way And thanks you for your order. Shipping up, update. Your order will arrive soon. Update your order.
Yeah.
And then you like this product. So I got the product, I think it was on the 7th of November.
Okay. And it was the jacket as advertised, so to speak.
Oh, stop. It was absolutely cruel. I have a small dog here, and I can guarantee you it wouldn't fit it. It wouldn't fit her. She's a small Shih Tzu.
Oh, Shih Tzu, appropriately enough. Oh, what would it call?
Kelly Galway.
Oh, Kelly Galway. Kelly, sorry. It's Kelly.
Yeah, yeah. $39.95. Looked fab in the pictures. It arrived a couple of days later, no, a couple of weeks later, actually, in a very small plastic bag.
Mm-hmm.
And I reckon it'll fit that man's Shih Tzu if you want to put me in touch with him.
And those calls kept coming pretty much all week. Shocking stuff. And if you did engage in email correspondence, well, you entered your own very special kind of hell. So much so that the Amdram team on Liveline took it on.
Mary Nagel here. I want a full refund of my €84 taken from my account on the 3rd of October. I have sent you the photos of the tops that I didn't order, no invoice received, no return address included. Please respond as a matter of urgency. Mary Nagel.
Hello, Mary. Thank you for reaching out to us, and I apologise for any inconvenience you faced with your recent order. I'm here to help resolve this for you quickly. Since you received items that you didn't order, I'm happy to offer you a couple of options. You can receive a 20% partial refund or choose a different size product for a small fee of €9.90 and keep the items. This choice not only helps you save a bit, but also supports environmental sustainability by reducing waste. If that doesn't suit you, I can provide you with a return address where you can send the items back at your expense and we'll issue a 25% partial refund. Please let me know which option you prefer and I'll be here to assist you further. Thank you for your understanding and patience. Annie B.
Dear Annie B, you are not understanding. I want my money back in full. You are not an Irish company based in Kildare. The two cheap, poor quality tops are postmarked in Beijing, China. I want my money back in full. I want my money back. Mary Nagel.
Hello, Mary. Thank you for reaching out to us and I apologise for any inconvenience you faced with your recent order. I'm here to help resolve this for you quickly. Please let me know which option you prefer and I'll be here to assist you further. Thank you for your understanding and patience.
So polite, so infuriating. Liveline. Back in a bit. Welcome back. The songs of Lou Reed sung by Anony, that we want to hear. And she spoke to Sean on Arena about their collaboration and friendship.
He had me sing Perfect Day and against this really different sort of arrangements, kind of amorphous kind of keyboard arrangement. And that was really the beginning of our relationship. My voice just like tickled a nerve in his imagination. And I think he always liked that juxtaposition of his hard voice and my kind of more fluid voice. We did a whole bunch of recording, ended up doing a bunch of background vocals for the whole record of Raven. And, I guess we started to become friends and we were in a taxi. I remember driving across the village and I just said to him, you know, there's a song of yours that I love so much, Candy Says. And he said, oh, it's just waiting for you to sing it. It's just waiting for you to sing it. You know, he said it with his really rough voice. And I thought, oh my God. And then when I did this show in November of 2011, I invited him to come and sing it with my band. We played it in almost like a very gentle kind of jazz way. And he sang it the crap out of it. He growled through that song, and it was probably the first time he'd sung it in a long time. It was just kind of mystical, really. I was stunned at the way that we were speaking across generations of sort of underground New York experience. Yeah. Like there was this kind of communing of like these basic themes that had also been, would become so central to the album of mine, I'm a Bird Now, ended up featuring a picture of Candy Darling on the cover. So it was a prelude to that, you know. We developed a relationship around the song Candy Says. He ended up having me sing Candy Says as the final song of every show we did on tour. And he would play the guitar and would just be the two of us, basically. Yeah. And he was determined that people to give me a platform as a singer.
Candy said, I've come to pay my body, and all it requires in this world. Candy says, I'd like to know completely, what are they so discreetly talking about?
I'm going to watch the bluebirds fly over my shoulder. I'm going to watch them pass me by. Maybe, baby, when I'm older,
what do you think I'd see if I could walk away from me?
Oh, that is beautiful and kind of fitting for this time of year. The trees are bare, there's darkness and damp on the ground. November can be a tough one, and it's still just a bit too early for all that ho-ho-ho business. But Michael Harding has a pill for that cough, a crackling fire and some hard liquor.
So, Michael, I had an expert on with me 2 weeks ago. She was a psychologist, and she was saying about one of the ways of getting over the winter blues is to reframe winter and tell yourself a different story around winter. So I'm trying to do that. Yeah. But then every year, November rolls around, and we forget how fast the darkness comes in and everything. How are you doing with the shorter days and the less light?
I'm doing well. I do honestly love the winter, and I love November. The reason I do, I suppose, if you think about the darkness, you can say to yourself, well, I dread the darkness. But if you think of a cozy fire in the evening, it's beautiful because of the darkness. And even if it's an electric fire with a flickering front to it, it's still lovely. There's things about winter and short days and long nights that you can get into in a positive way, and you can sit by the fire, you can have a little whiskey if you like, a little alcohol, and you can think about your old friends and people that you remember and your ancestors, your parents. It's a time to kind of, you know, even remember on Sunday. This is the time for remembering all the people who have blessed us and been good to us and given us life and given us birth. So it's a lovely time at the end of the year to be grateful for everything. And that's the way I'd look at November. It's a positive time. And in the darkness, have yourself a little candle, have yourself a little fire, have yourself a little whiskey if you fancy alcohol. Yeah.
And Harding, being Harding, sees the existential in the changing of the seasons.
There is a beauty to melancholy. There is a beauty to kind of letting yourself feel that sadness of even age. I'm 71, and I enjoy, like, the idea. People say you shouldn't say you're old, but I like saying I'm old. I like saying it's okay to be old. It's okay for the leaves falling from the tree as they do outside at the moment. And because it's been such a dry autumn and such a, you know, there hasn't been, there's only one windy storm, but so there's a lot of leaves still on the trees. And it's beautiful to see them, and then the assault, the yellow leaf on the floor, on the ground as you're walking on it. It's just, there's so much about aging, there's so much about the end of the year, that rather than be afraid of it, yeah, and rather than even be afraid of aging, embrace it, because there's something very, very beautiful you'll find in the middle of it.
So decay and disintegration is actually just another part of the cycle. It's not necessarily a bad thing, like.
It's It's a cycle that you see everything decaying and look out at the bare trees and remember that next April and next spring, they will grow magnificently again. They'll grow all their complex leaves in the same way. That in itself is a beautiful lesson. But it's also like the loveliness of the winter is the fact that on the surface things die, but deep underneath, there's something we all know. We kind of endure in a stronger way underneath. We endure darkness. And that's the kind of image I think of the candle that lights in the dark.
Michael Harding with Brendan. And on Mooney Goes Wild, the sweeping and swirling of murmurations, for it is at their time of year and a wonder to behold. Here's Jim Wilson.
A murmuration, the word really is a crossword word, if you know what I mean. It's a fancy word for a great big flock of starlings, and in particular starlings that are about to go to rest for the night. They're about to go to sleep and find somewhere safe, and they come together in huge numbers, sometimes 10, 15, 20, 50, 100,000, 200,000 birds. Every now and again, every couple of years, there's one or two places in Ireland where you get these absolutely enormous concentrations of them, and they behave like an organism. I'm sure people have at this stage seen them if they didn't know what they were called. These big blobs of birds, and they're making all sorts of amazing shapes in the sky as if they were literally one organism alive. And in fact, for a while, scientists believed that maybe they were a super organism because they must have had incredible control to duck and dive and not always be bumping into each other and things like that. And when you do watch it, I mean, everyone, it should be on your bucket list. Ireland is not that big. You need to go and see one of these. And Birdwatch Ireland usually lets people know through their Facebook page and things like that where the best ones are and when the best time is to go to see them.
But is all of that spectacle, the gliding, the dipping, a celebration of the sheer joy of being alive? I think you know the answer. But if not, here's Niall Hatch.
One of the things is, first of all, people ask, well, why do they do this? Because it would seem to be a colossal waste of energy. They spend all day eating food and trying to get fit and healthy, and then they're expending this huge amount of energy. So a lot of it's still a little bit of guesswork as to why they do it, but it's thought that, it's safety in numbers, that these birds could be quite vulnerable, the perfect size for a hawk or a falcon to pick off and eat. So if they're all gathered together in a big group, well, that's more pairs of eyes looking out for danger, so you're more likely to see that predator coming. Now, you can't stop it coming, but the fact is, when you have these big displays, it's very disorientating. If you see a murmuration this winter, try focus for, if you can, on one single bird. You won't do it for very long because it's impossible to track one bird. So that's thought maybe to disorientate or dazzle the predator. The other thing, of course, if that predator does come in, it may still take a starling, but the odds are it's going to be your neighbour rather than you. So you'll probably survive.
Happy days.
Absolutely. Now, as to how they actually manage to do it, they know from looking at slowed down camera footage, each starling seems to be extremely sensitive and picking up on the movements of the seven birds closest to it. And when it moves in faster than the human brain or the human eye could actually even calculate this, they react. So they're all sort of weaving around each other, but they never collide. There's never big crashes or anything like that, or very rarely. So it's incredible. But it has to go beyond conscious thought because their brains just couldn't react that quickly if they were thinking about the movement. They just have to sort of surrender to the flock and just let go of the flow, almost literally.
From Mooney Goes Wild. And more science for the season on Drive Time. Yes, it's a bit of a chestnut. But let's settle it yet again for another November. No, we're not being precious. We just feel the cold more. It's biology, baby.
Why are women such cold-blooded creatures?
Hi, Carmen. How you doing? Well, it's not that we're cold-blooded. In fact, our core temperature is higher than men's. Oh. But it's more how we experience our thermal environment.
Leona Donaghy, healthy building consultant, not taking the bait.
There's different things come into it, but the sensors are on our skin and they're sensing the difference between that and the core. And so what happens in women is they vasoconstrict their hands and feet. So their hands and feet are actually feeling they're colder than their core. And then it's that difference that makes women feel like they need a higher temperature to feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm. So there. But if you would expect the thermostat to be adjusted accordingly, you would be wrong.
D
do the buildings reflect, like public buildings, for example, or office blocks or, you know, places where, you know, there's a mixture of men and women all the time? Do they reflect this reality, lived reality?
No, they don't. Unfortunately, so most building service engineers are retirement age, and back then the calculations were made on working age male. And their metabolism, because the metabolic rate goes into the equation for thermal comfort. So it's very important. And a woman's rest and metabolic rate is different from a man. So it doesn't. The buildings are underperforming by about 35% for having female occupants. So it's no wonder that women are always complaining. And their office attire for females is a lower clove value, they talk about it. So it's light blouses and skirt, like the general attire for women is cold, like it's not as insulating. So your women are losing more heat as well.
So what if increased blood circulation, would that help, I wonder, if you did jack jumps or squats or press ups or whatever?
Probably, but it would. It depends what your job is. I'm not sure if you could really.
I'm just trying to find solutions. Well, there you go. Oh, Cormac O'Hara, always ready with a solution for whoever.
How about the men start wearing blouses and we turn the heat up?
Well, we wear long johns already, Sarah, so that's the problem sorted there. Anyway, Leona Donaghy, before you start a fight here on Drive Time.
Wouldn't take much to start that scrap, in fairness. But that information adds an extra dimension of cruelty to this next clip.
Ah! Oh my God. And I mean, oh my God.
Sinead Nuilchán in a freezing plunge pool at the Hot Box Sauna in Inchicore in Dublin. The things she does for the Darcy. Ray, though, oh, he's not getting in. Oh, no. He's chin-stroking on the sidelines, musing about the Irish and their bodies, because these saunas, well, all a bit newfangled. We wouldn't have traditionally been great at getting the kit off.
We were thinking that maybe it's about our relationship with our bodies, Sinead.
That could be it too.
Like the Scandinavians are a lot freer about the human body. It is just but the human body. But for whatever reason, I don't know if it's the Catholic Church or whatever, we're a little bit more self-conscious when it comes to nudity.
Repressed, Ray. Just say it.
Even like changing into your togs if you're on the beach and you have the towel around you and the towel is slipping and you're trying to grab it and grab hold of your bits, you know yourself. It's tough. Multitasking.
I'm constantly reminded by my wife, Jenny, that it's a lot more difficult for women than men. That part of the going for a swim bit. The changing, you know, it's a lot more difficult because you've more bits, I suppose, to cover up than men.
He feels our pain. Nevertheless, Sinead, in you get. Yeah, the cold one.
We have three different ones here. One's at about 6 degrees now. That's freezing cold.
That's cold,
yes. We have one here at 17 degrees. Right. And then we have a nice warm one at 32 to kind of chill out in and relax after.
And which one did you choose for Sinead?
She's in the 17 degree pool today.
Ah, come on, Sinead, you wussy.
No, I'm too much of a chicken, Ray.
Come on.
Okay, I'll put my feet into the 6 degrees one. We'll
they're
see.
Called plunge, not dip.
So do I have to jump in?
Well, it's not the way down. Yeah. You're supposed to jump in, aren't you? Yeah.
Well, lower yourself.
Yeah, lower yourself slowly into them. Really.
Right. Okay.
It gets messy when you're doing cannonballs into them.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, I give it a go.
Give it a go there. Yes.
Oh, this is different. Okay. I know that there's a difference now. Sorry. Oh my God. And I'm in. Oh my God. Okay, my feet are freezing. My whole body's freezing. Okay. I think I'm going to have to go back into the sauna.
That's going to do you a world of good. That's going to do you a world of good. You'll thank us later for that.
She won't on to HR as we speak. But that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
It's up in the morning, it's on the dance, and little white clouds like a gambling lane.